This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your state society of CPAs for your personal non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Requests for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the weekly tax update for October 7th, 2013. We only have five topics this week, in part because the government shut down a lot of the flow of information that we would normally look to. And by the way, there will be no podcast for next week. Due to the government shutdown, there will be no podcast for October 14th, 2013. So let's take a brief look at what we have to work on. First, in Steinberg versus Commissioner, 141 TC 8, we have the tax court refusing to give the government summary judgment on the question of valuing a gift where the donees agreed to pay the gift tax and to reimburse any estate tax that might be due if the donor died within 3 years of the gift. Then, Frontier Custom Builders, a classic 263 Cap A case. If you have clients who are home builders, you certainly want to be familiar with the court's decision in Frontier Custom Builders. And then we are, of course, the tax news has been full of the acceptance by the Supreme Court of the quality stores issue. There's conflict among the circuits on whether separation payments are subject to FICA. The government and the taxpayer have framed the issue quite differently. And then our fourth item is whether or not the employer can deduct the costs of providing the employee access to a bike share program. And it's in here just as an illustration of the ridiculous level to which the tax code is interfering in our daily lives. And yes, that's my opinion, and we'll talk about that when we get there. And finally, a decision in the Sixth Circuit, which on its face simply affirms the judgment of U.S. District Court that an individual cannot succeed with a claim of fraud against the trustees of her boyfriend's estate. But the reason I picked it is it's an example of what a CPA firm should not get itself involved in, because as a result of exercising poor judgment, this CPA firm was involved in litigation for a long time, a lot of expenses, partners had to go and be deposed, and even though ultimately they won, I assure you that they lost in terms of prestige, time, and the quality control in the tax practice. This firm needs to give some serious thought to client acceptance and client retention. In any event, let's get started. In Gene Steinberg, 141 TC number 8, the court denies the IRS's motion for summary judgment, holding that a group of gift donees, the donor's daughters, assumption of potential Section 2035B estate tax liability. This is a liability that will only come about if the donor dies within 3 years of making the gift. So it's not a real liability, it's very contingent, but the question is, can it be valued? And if it can be valued actuarially, then can that value reduce the value of the gift? To give you some idea of what we're talking about here, the aggregate net value of the gifts to the three daughters is $71,598,000. The agreement with the daughters is that Ms. Steinberg would give cash and securities. The daughters agreed to pay the resulting gift tax liability, which is known, that can be calculated, as well as any resulting estate tax liability under 2035B. Now, 2035B is the estate, it was passed by Congress to deal with the estate depletion theory. If I give away property and my estate pays the gift tax, then my taxable estate is reduced by the amount of the gift tax, right? Well, in order to deal with that and make arrangements for the value of the gift to be affected by the assumption of that liability, the taxpayers in this case, a lot of money involved, had very good advice. So they claimed they had the value of the gift appraised by a competent appraiser who said that there was a value to this agreement to pay estate tax if any should become due. So the fundamental question that the court dealt with was the fair market value of the property rights transferred under the agreement. Court rejected the claim that the daughter's assumption of potential liability was worthless under the estate depletion theory and declined to follow the tax court's own holding in McCord, principally because the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals had overturned the tax court's holding in McCord on a very similar issue. The majority seemed to be rock solid in their view. Two judges concurred in the majority opinion, but had to add concerns about other things. And one judge, veteran tax court judge James Halpern, dissented from the majority opinion. But it's important to know that with this decision simply denied summary judgment, trial on the issue is yet to come. And we need to remember the gift tax was a known amount. The estate tax is not known. And if Ms. Steinberg lives past the 3 years, there would be no estate tax, and the value of the gift would have been reduced by an actuarial calculation of a liability that never came to pass. And in this case, it was about $5 million discount. And so the IRS is fighting for $5 million, essentially. Or they're fighting for the tax on $5 million. Next, we have Frontier Custom Home Builders, Frontier Custom Builders, Inc., TC Memo 2013-231. Here, the court finds a portion of the adjustments the IRS made to custom home building company's income are accurate. The company was not entitled to deduct all costs and expenses of its business, but should have capitalized a portion of those costs and expenses because the home builder is a producer of real property under Section 263A. The tax court considers six issues. One, whether Frontier, a custom home builder, is required to capitalize rather than deduct all direct and certain indirect costs of production. Court said yes, it is. Two, whether Frontier can change its accounting method without having previously secured respondent's consent, the IRS's consent. Court holds that it cannot. And so the court has to decide whether the IRS's determination that the taxpayer must change from an improper to a proper method is unlawful. We hold that it is not unlawful. Whether Frontier must capitalize a portion of the cost of its officer's compensation. The court says yes, it must. Four, whether Frontier must capitalize a portion of the cost of its non-officer employees' compensation. The court says yes, it must. Five, whether Frontier must capitalize a portion of its other expenses incurred. Yes, it must. And finally, number six, whether Frontier qualifies for adjustments for other tax years through the mitigation provision. And here the court is skeptical that the taxpayer will probably not be able to access mitigation, but defers consideration of the mitigation request until a decision in the five previously considered issues is final. The adjustments to Frontier's income in 2005, and apparently Frontier had not complied with 263 Cap A before 2005. So their accounting method was an erroneous method. It was simply not to comply with 263 Cap A. Then in their 2005 return, apparently they got a new accountant or their accountant got an education or something happened because this has been the rule since 1987. In their 2005 return, they attempted to adopt 263 Cap A, but they left a lot of things out. In fact, they left out $1,888,625 that should have been capitalized as of the beginning of the year. In addition, there was an annual adjustment to that 263 Cap A amount of $165,949, and Frontier is looking at a tax of $653,272. Frontier started in 1990, so they were founded after 263 Cap A became part of the Internal Revenue Code in 1986. They're incorporated in 1992. On their 2005 tax return, they capitalized direct material and labor costs and post-production period carrying costs, but deducted all salaries, all year-end bonuses, and all other miscellaneous expenses. They used the same accounting method for tax that they used for financial accounting. They did not submit a Form 3115. They didn't seek to change their accounting method, so they didn't ask for or receive permission to change. They maintained no contemporaneous time records showing how many hours Frontier employees spent on their various activities. So first, the court considers the activities by each employee, including the president of the company. Next, the court considers carrying costs. In 2005, the taxpayer capitalized post-production period carrying costs, which were incurred to keep the homes in a marketable condition. But Frontier did not seek permission to change. In 2004, they didn't do that. Can they just start in 2005 and do that? No. You have an accounting method change, and the accounting method change has to be effective as of the beginning of the year of change. So the accounting method change has to identify all of the costs which should have been capitalized at the beginning of 2005, and those are the subject of a 41A adjustment. But they didn't do that. They just changed the way they accounted for things. Then they ignored a lot of other expenses. employee benefits, insurance, including the builder's risk insurance, which was specific to a specific home, office expenses, mobile telephone expenses, tool expenses, training and seminar expenses, utility expenses, and the court found that some part of all of those expenses should have been capitalized as a production cost. As to Frontier's claim to mitigation, that was premature, and I can't really understand how they would ever benefit from mitigation in that there doesn't appear to be any duplication in the IRS's approach. The bottom line here is that we need to be thoughtful in identifying our clients who are in a production activity, and if we identify a client who is in a production activity, we need to request permission to change our method of accounting before we just do it and hope no one notices. Just a comment or two about the grant of certiorari in the Quality Stores case. The government frames the issue as to whether severance payments made to employees whose employment was involuntarily terminated, were taxable under FICA. Quality Stores describes the question as whether supplemental unemployment compensation benefits, as those are defined in 34020, constitute wages. Now, the unique thing about Quality Stores case, they made these severance payments pursuant to a plan, which is all Code Section 34020 requires. It happened to be pursuant to a plan of bankruptcy, but the payments were made pursuant to a plan nonetheless. So we'll have to see. The Supreme Court has accepted it, the appeal, the government's appeal, by the way, not the taxpayer's appeal, and the taxpayer has responded. And so sometime within the next year or so, the Supreme Court will speak. Meanwhile, there are over $1 billion of protective claims that are being suspended. Many taxpayers have executed with the IRS a Form 907, the agreement to extend the time to bring suit. 11 cases, more than 2,400 refund claims. So this is an important issue for the Supreme Court to decide. Next, information release 2013-0032. Under Section 132A5 of the Code, employers that provide their employees with transportation benefits can exclude those benefits from the employee's gross income, gross wages, if the benefits are qualified transportation fringes. That's defined in 132F. Under 132F1B, a qualified transportation fringe includes a transit pass, and a transit pass is a pass, token, fare card, voucher, or similar item for transportation on mass transit facilities. And the information release has that in bold. A bike share program is not a mass transit facility, okay? Then 132F1D lists what a qualified transportation fringe is. It includes any qualified bicycle commuting reimbursement, but a qualified bicycle commuting reimbursement is for the reasonable expenses incurred by the employee during the calendar year for the purchase of a bicycle, bicycle improvements, bicycle repair, and bicycle storage if the bicycle is regularly used for travel between the employer's residence and the employee's residence and the place of employment. Now, for the employer to pay for the employee's participation in a bike share program, according to the IRS, is neither for the purchase, the repair, the storage of a bicycle. And so our federal government has invested God knows how many hours of a valuable employee's time and God knows how many hours of legislators' time in drafting the original regulation, the original statute, which distinguished between my bicycle and a bicycle that I might share with someone else. Proof positive that if the federal government is involved at this level in my use of a bicycle, we may have too much federal government. Finally this week, Mary Vanderheed. Now, here's the deal. Mary Vanderheed was the longtime girlfriend of Donald Chin. Donald Chin established a revocable living trust. When he was afflicted with dementia and was incompetent, his lawyer and his accountant, who had been designated as trustees, stepped in, and they continued to make payments for the benefit of his longtime girlfriend, but then they issued Forms 1099, which for non-employee compensation. Ms. Vanderheed, I think, appropriately points out that she never performed compensated services for Chin, and so she sued the lawyer and the accountant and the accounting firm. Now, ultimately, the court says, as a matter of law, Chin, not the trustees, qualified as the filer of the 1099s because the trustees were acting as his agents, and they simply filed them on behalf of his trust. So that would defeat the Section 7434 claim that the 1099s were issued without any justification. The state law claim for conspiracy and intentional infliction of emotional distress were time-barred. They were too late. The attorney's representative capacity precluded an independent claim against him for breach of contract. And since Vanderheed was not a client of the Doran Mayhew firm, she had no standing to sue them. But that didn't keep this case from consuming a lot of time and costing a lot of money. The point I want to make with it is that neither Doran Mayhew, the firm, nor any of its partners should ever have allowed itself to get in a situation where it was making these kinds of decisions for a client who was incompetent. It's always very flattering when the client says, "Would you be the trustee of my trust?" Well, yes, I'll be glad. But it's dangerous. And this decision, the fact that the litigation itself is proof that as the independent CPA providing accounting and tax services and planning services, I have no business allowing myself to be in the position of trustee, because that carries unique liabilities. And I'm sure that the lawyer and the accountant were doing what they thought was right for their client. Maybe they even thought they were protecting him against Ms. Vanderheed, but that's not their job. The accountant, for sure, is not trained to protect anybody. Well, it's a wrap for this week. As usual, stay safe.